From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we profile two of the Wisconsinites vying to be the Democratic nominee for governor.
First, we hear from political newcomer Josh Paid, and then we'll have a conversation with former state representative Kelda Royce.
Later in the show, how Milwaukee Water Commons has changed since its inception.
Now, Milwaukee Water Commons really fully identifies as an environmental justice organization. And it really is a lot about access and about that inequality of the benefits, along with the responsibilities around water.
And why those who work in fine crafts depend on events like this weekend's Morning Glory Fine Craft Fair.
When you're doing creative pieces, unique pieces of art, your public, your customer, likes to see, touch, feel, ask how you made it. These are all things that are very difficult to do digitally.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. In just under a week, voters will head to the polls to pick who will be on the ballot for governor this November. This week, Lake Effect and WUWM News have been profiling the political contenders vying for your vote.
WUWM's Marty Michelson had a chance to speak with each of the candidates. She asked each of them why they wanted to run for governor and the message they hope voters will take away from their campaigns.
We've been airing the candidate conversations in alphabetical order, so today we start with political newcomer and attorney Josh Paid.
Marty spoke with him after the Democratic gubernatorial debate that was held in Milwaukee last month. Paid says that if he's elected, he plans to take the state in a new direction.
I'm running because Wisconsin needs to go in a new direction. We need to start a new chapter in our politics, in our economy, in our education. For working families all across the state, whether they're farmers or working in cities, we need a new chapter. And we can't do that unless we have new leadership. I've been privileged to come out of very, very hard circumstances in my life. I lost my parents growing up and was given the opportunity to work across the state of Wisconsin. So I understand all the different communities and how they're interconnected, how they're the same and how they're different. And I think if we have a new leader that's going to create a better Wisconsin for our children, it's going to be someone that has that kind of background that I have. And I'm very passionate about the kind of policies it takes to give people opportunity, and I think we can be an opportunity state again.
What are the top three issues facing Wisconsinites, and how do you plan to address them?
The first is wages. People are working hard, but they're not making enough money. They're squeezed by healthcare costs. They're squeezed by cost of housing. Everywhere, they're just getting squeezed. And no one is addressing their needs. No one's listening to them, and they want someone to listen and be heard. So my first thing is to give them opportunity again. Match skill sets to the new jobs. Create the new economy jobs here in Wisconsin that pay good wages. We do need to raise the minimum wage, but we also need to do things like, you know, rework the tax code so that we can have a powerful, fundable tax credits for our middle-class working people across the state of Wisconsin. And that's some of the big ideas I want to produce. The second one is the environment. I lost my mom to lung cancer. She was not a smoker. So having clean air and clean water is very personal to me. We can build an entire new industry of green jobs across the state. We can have clean water. We can reinvest in our infrastructure. And we can do that without costs, because we're going to bring investment to every county in the state. And I think that's a huge thing we're going to do, and we'll be rolling out an initiative to make Wisconsin renewable by 2050 or sooner. The third one is education, and that's primary, secondary education, higher education. We need to make Wisconsin an education-focused state again. We need a modern education system that's connected to the 21st century economy. We need to provide accountability and money to all of our schools. We need to give local schools control. And we need to have higher education that's available to everyone. I've been talking about a public service initiative that'll connect people to higher education through public service. And I think that it's going to be a game changer and make Wisconsin a leader again in the country.
How do you differentiate yourself from the other candidates?
So I'm not embroiled in the politics of Madison. I'm not a typical politician, and I think I'm bringing new voices, new ideas to the conversation. If we are going to win in November, it's going to be more than just fixing the problems. It's going to be establishing what our future is going to look like, what Wisconsin is going to be like in 2030. The governor needs to establish a long-term vision when it comes to investing in our infrastructure, having roads and bridges that last for the next 30 years, having whatever the next generation of transportation is going to be, whether that's high-speed rail, Rail or Hyperloop or just autonomous vehicles. How are we going to accommodate that? We can bring so much new investment here to Wisconsin and do that with the right vision if we have these new ideas. And if we're just talking about the past, we're not going to get there. So I just want to do that. Wisconsin's last in the country in new businesses, and I actually partnered with the foundation that did that study, and I said, how do we fix that? So we have a comprehensive plan that frankly transcends Republican and Democrat on how to get people from idea to market. And that's going to be huge. 4 out of 5 employees in the state of Wisconsin work for a company that's 16 years or older. And those are old jobs, and they're not hiring in mature companies. If we invest in homegrown businesses, those are going to be high-paying new jobs here in the state of Wisconsin. And we're going to do that and have a one-stop shop for people to navigate the road to starting a business.
In what areas do you think you're vulnerable?
You know, I'm an underdog. I'm the underdog candidate for governor. I came here, I'm not backed by an establishment group or a special interest or a billionaire family that wants to take over the state. I'm running on grassroots and good ideas, and it's been a lot of work. And we've been thrilled and overwhelmed by the response across the state. I have worked across the state of Wisconsin, knowing communities, working in their communities, bagging their groceries. And understanding that and then going and talking to them and listening to them and empowering them, that's how we're going to win this election, and that's how I've gotten this far.
Josh Pade is an attorney and one of the people vying to be Wisconsin's Democratic candidate for governor.
We turn now to candidate Kelda Royce of Madison. Marty caught up with the former state representative during a campaign event in Wauwatosa. She wanted to know what made Royce decide to get into the race.
I'm Kelda Royce, and I'm running for governor to restore opportunity and fairness to Wisconsin. I want it to be a place where everyone has the opportunity to succeed.
What are the top 3 issues facing Wisconsinites, and how do you plan to address them?
Public education, health care, and growing our economy, I think, are the 3 top issues, because that's what I hear about as I travel around the state. We need to make sure that public dollars are invested in public education only, and that we stop funding private schools who are unaccountable to taxpayers with our public funds. We also need to make sure that public schools are funded equitably so that rural districts and urban districts are not disadvantaged by our funding formula. In terms of healthcare, I think we need to expand access to healthcare so that all Wisconsinites are covered and address the high cost of prescription drugs. I would help make Badger Care an option that anyone could buy into. And as a small business owner myself, I know how critical the ability to buy affordable health care is to small businesses. So this is an important economic issue as well. In terms of the economy, I think that we can grow a strong and vibrant economy by helping invest in small businesses, not corporate welfare deals like Foxconn, which we might never ever even see a return on, but on helping small businesses grow and succeed, whether it's family farmers or entrepreneurs or somebody who wants to open a coffee shop on Main Street.
How do you differentiate yourself from the other candidates?
Well, we've got great candidates running, but I've got the track record of actually turning big ideas into real results. I was a legislative leader, and I reached across the aisle and helped make Wisconsin one of the first states to ban BPA, a toxic chemical, in children's products. I also helped expand Badger Care to over 80,000 Wisconsinites. And I helped pass the first pro-choice law in 30 years in Wisconsin through an anti-choice Republican-controlled assembly. So I've got the skills to actually get things done as governor, and the positive vision to get us there.
In what areas do you think you're vulnerable?
Well, I think some people question whether or not somebody who carried the flag for a reproductive rights organization can win statewide, but you know, Wisconsin is a pro-choice state. And what I learned when I was the head of NARAL Pro-Choice Wisconsin is that people in Wisconsin want to be left alone. We want to make our own private medical decisions. And in fact, our current governor, who's a Republican, ran ads basically implying wrongly that he was pro-choice. With Roe v. Wade hanging in the balance, I think that reproductive rights and specifically access to abortion are going to be essential issues because Wisconsin has a criminal abortion ban already on the books in our state. So abortion will immediately be illegal if Roe v. Wade is overturned here in Wisconsin. We need a governor that is willing to stand up for the rights of women to make their own health care decisions.
Kelda Royce is a former state representative, and she is one of the people vying to be the Democratic gubernatorial candidate for Wisconsin. She spoke with WUWM's Marty Michelson.
We'll continue our look at these candidates the rest of the week. To see a full profile of each of the candidates, you can head to WUWM.com.
Things are changing at Milwaukee Water Commons as one of its leaders moves on to other ventures. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz talks with Ann Brummett right after this short break. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Food is, of course, one of the main pillars of health. But the kinds of food we eat can cancel out all the positive effects of other healthy habits, like getting enough exercise and sleep. There is a lot of conflicting information about what is good for you and how you should determine the best diet for your particular circumstances.
Christy Linebaugh and Miriam Vigoa owned a restaurant together in Florida. Miriam's family's seasoned olive oil recipe quickly became a bestseller. And now the women travel the country helping others eat well and feel better using that olive oil. On this episode of Fit for You, they explain to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski how they became healthy food advocates through olive oil.
So the craziest thing is we started off as a coffee house, and within a few months people were like, why aren't we eating here? It's very inconvenient. Just have coffee. We want to eat here as well. And so I told Miriam, oh my God, I don't know how to cook. What are we going to do? All these people want to eat here. And she said, well, I'll make my seasoned olive oil. If you just splash it on everything, people will think you know how to cook. And I'm like, perfect. And so that's what we started doing. So I just started literally making very tiny little sandwiches and putting her seasoned olive oil on it. And everybody went so crazy over it, they started asking her to bottle it. And she was like, no, we have the restaurant. And so she started bottling it. We actually went on to win 13 People's Choice Awards using her seasoned olive oil. So I would tell everybody I can't cook, but I splash. And that's what we always called it, was splash. And so our whole restaurant was literally based on the idea of shake, splash, and eat. And so all the seasonings, herbs, and spices are in the bottle. And so we did that for over 20 years. And it's funny because people will say, well, why'd you leave the restaurant? Well, the restaurant left us. It was destroyed by a flood. So.
Oh, no. Okay. So it was an easy decision.
Yeah.
Well, decision made for you.
That's right. So we tell everybody we didn't go out with a bang. We went out with a splash.
Okay.
So we said, well, we'll go full-time selling our seasoned olive oils. And everybody would say, why do we feel so good when we eat here and we feel so horrible when we eat at other places?
So your restaurant was healthy, focused, health-centric.
Yeah, definitely.
Actually, our customers, they would bring in bottles, empty bottles, and have us send some at home for the salads and so forth. The bottles became bigger and bigger, and it was them who finally talked me into researching and bottling it. And
so how did you first come to make olive oils? Was it a family recipe and tradition?
Yeah,
the
Canary Islands is where my family is from. And the original recipe was from my great-grandmother. And then it was, given down to, this is our fourth generation that we used to make it at home and for, special occasions. But in my case, I started making it for the restaurant. I've always been a health advocate. I enjoy the clean eating. I've always have. And so I created something that would substitute the sodiums and the artificial ingredients and the GMOs. If you notice, our product is very simple, very clean, and it helps. It gives you the flavor besides the benefits.
Well, and I imagine owning a restaurant, you do have some control over what food you serve, what ingredients you serve. Was there also a problem with finding food distributors that didn't serve, quote, real food?
Absolutely.
That you had difficulties tracking down just simple food?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And, we would go to these food expos, food shows, and they would give us the samples. And the first thing I would do is look at the ingredients. And I looked at Christy and I said, oh, my gosh, it's 5,000 milligrams of sodium by the time you eat a cup and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So that really motivated me to initially create the olive oil. I changed a little bit from the original recipe so that it would serve the people that had high blood pressure or diabetes or heart issues. And then much later on, this is 22 years ago, when we didn't talk about inflammation, we didn't talk about the side effects that it could lead us to. We started something that had no idea what path it would take us, but here we are.
Yeah, it was funny because when we first opened, Miriam was like, don't tell people the food is healthy because they won't want to eat here, you know? And it was true. So I would tell people that, you know, we never really focused on the health benefits as far as like blatantly telling people. It was just that they continued to say, oh, we feel so good when we eat here. We feel so good, you know? And so we really didn't even promote that it was a healthy ingredient. We just would tell people it's the splash, you know?
Well, on that note, do you think that American food culture in particular, we don't put enough emphasis on into really paying attention into how we feel, say, before, during, after we eat, or paying attention to what's in our ingredients? You know, you don't want to drive customers away by saying we're a healthy restaurant,
right?
Because of whether we like it or not, that is not what people go out for.
Absolutely.
You know.
And that's really the thing, is that we really started focusing on, I actually have lost 50 pounds using it. And so what we always tell people is that, you know, maybe you're not necessarily fat, overweight. Maybe there's a lot of inflammation there, you know. And so it's like you start getting rid of the chemicals and you're realizing, oh, I really wasn't eating a ton to be so overweight. I was actually having inflammation from all the sodium and the sugar and the MSG and the GMOs. And so that was our main focus, is, you know, how do you feel when you eat? Is it like swallowing the devil because now you've got so much acid reflux that you're on fire? You know, have you eaten out and you're like, oh, I feel good for 5 minutes, and then you feel horrible and you know, or you're sick the rest of the night. You know, we would hear people say that, well, you know, the next morning I can't get my rings off, you know, because that really, you can get over 3,000 milligrams of sodium at some of the restaurants. We talk about that in our book, too, is that you don't realize, because you would never use that much sodium at home, you know, so there's no way people can even comprehend how much chemicals and sugar and salt are in the food.
Right, so even if people are conscious to not, say, add extra salt shakers, you know, doing that to their food, if they say, oh, I've cut back so much, is that really the case? Because we don't pay close attention.
Absolutely. And I think, too, because it's not reality. Like, at home, if you're going to salt something, as far as, like, just a little shakes here and there, people don't realize, you know, we talk about in the book, too, that sliced turkey, you think you're being healthy, and you go out and you're like, oh, I'm going to get a turkey, sliced turkey sandwich. You know, and some of the, depending on the brands, you can get as much sodium as Spam. You know, and you're thinking, oh, my God, well, I'm having sliced turkey, I'm eating healthy. But the problem is, it's the fillers and everything, that you actually get less protein in deli turkey than you do real turkey because there's so many fillers. And I think that's where we're not comprehending, because it looks like turkey, you know, tastes like turkey.
So where do you think, with your experience running a restaurant, knowing where your food comes from, and then yourself adapting how you eat, do you think that, especially if you notice, Miriam, a difference in food culture and where our food comes from the Canary Islands versus here, is the American food system setting people up to fail?
You know, that is always going to be around, that food culture that we are calling it. So basically, I think that for the majority of the people, they are so enthralled in the now that they're not really paying attention on the health benefits that they could achieve if they would change their diet. I think that a lot of times we go out to eat, and it reminds them of how grandmother would make a gravy or a turkey, but they don't realize that that is all manufactured, it's food technology.
In your book, you mention a note that intrigued me. There's the real food, the food, and the food product.
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, there's that's what we talked about in Kraft macaroni, or, you know, different products that they were literally not able to say that it was a food. They had to call it, you know, the cheese product, because the there's such a small amount of food in there versus, you know, they call it cheese food instead of cheese, because there has to be a certain amount of actual food in there to be classified as food. And I think that's what happens, is we all start thinking of, well, these cheese slices are $1.99. Why would I pay $5 for these other cheese slices. And so we've been kind of trained to look at the prices, well, because everybody wants to save money, but we're not thinking, well, there's got to be, why is there such a big difference? You know, not thinking of, oh, this because it's not actually even food.
What are some other basic tips that you would give to people who say they want to take the first step in maybe paying attention a little more to what they're eating? You know, what are some friendly first steps to do versus doing the extreme of I need to go on a complete cleanse or, you know, things that maybe set people back a little more than it's helpful?
Right. I think a diary, a food diary, let's say for the first 3 days, for the first 4 days, you write down everything that you're eating and what reactions your body is taking. And personally, I follow the blood type diet. It's a biological diet, and it's worked for me.
Yeah,
so.
What I like to do also is, because I really wasn't on board in the very beginning of, because Miriam had been very much into eating healthy her whole life, and I really wasn't on board as far as that goes as much as she was. And so the fact that it was extremely simple, and so with the shake, splash, and eat, you know, shockingly simple recipes is really how we started doing it at the restaurant, is because it took the fear out of it. And I think that's a huge thing, is because you start talking about changing the way somebody eats, the way that somebody's done something their entire life, their fear comes in of, I don't know how to do it, I don't have time to do it, where am I going to get this special food, where do I have to shop? And so,
you know, what we haven't talked about is the celiacs, the wheat, the genetically modified. That has taken a lot of people's attention, and you know, this is the first step they take to eliminate all the whites, simple carbs. That sometimes that's the initiative, but they immediately start feeling better.
Do you feel that a lot of people are misdiagnosed with things like irritable bowel syndrome, or you know, maybe they think they're gluten intolerant when in fact it's a multitude of other foods they're consuming?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
So the simplest way, what I would do in the beginning, stay away from all the whites, all the sugars and the sodium and the wheat, anything that is genetically modified that you know of. And if you don't know it, look it up. You know, you have to do your research. And within 2 weeks, you immediately will see the change. Change in vitality, change in relief of pain. And actually, your joints, they're not swollen anymore. You can take your rings off after the next day.
I think, too, what happens is that because we are so rushed in today's society, you know, many people are working more than one job and taking care of children and sports and animals, and we want things as easy and fast as possible. And so we go to the marinades and all the dressings and all the flavorings. And so we say, well, I'm going to cook at home real quick and I'm just going to grab this bottle of, well, you know, maybe now you've started off with this beautiful piece of chicken and these fresh vegetables. Now you've just dumped, you know, pre-made dressings and stuff that were made with soybean oil and cottonseed oil and canola oil, which cause inflammation. So you start with that oil, and then you start adding MSG and sugar and salt, and it's like, oh my gosh, it's like this, you know, inflammation bomb goes off. And a lot of people are like, well, like what you were saying before, I don't use salt at home, and I don't use MSG. And I'm like, well, you don't really have to, because it's already in there.
So you guys went from both sides of prepping food, owning a restaurant, and then you yourself, Christy, having, you know, your own food transformation and health and weight loss. You know, what did you find the most satisfying in your roles in the restaurant career? And then what do you find the most satisfying now as traveling chefs and real food advocates?
Well, on the road, we get to meet a lot of people that are suffering. They're suffering from diabetes. They're suffering from high blood pressure. And that to us, you know, knowing what we know and knowing all the people that have shared with us, most of the times, is the digestive system that is totally, it's like an epidemic. I'm not really sure what word I want to use, but I want to serve them some of the knowledge that we have learned, and that we know it works. And so that's much different than being at the restaurant. at the restaurant. My job was in the back sometimes. We both traded because we did different venues and different activities. So, you know, we each had different times that we were cooking. That we wanted to give our customers the very, very best. They knew that everything that they were eating, it was just about love. It was a farm-to-table restaurant. So we knew the person that, you know, the eggs came from, this chicken, and they even had names.
Yeah.
We knew the arugula guy, you know, that sort of thing. And it was wonderful. I mean, the restaurant business is very hard. It was challenging, but it was satisfactory because our customers. But the community, total community, supported us and relied on us.
Yeah, one of our customers says, that darn olive oil, why you guys have to travel all over the country? And Miriam's like, well, it's y'all's fault because you're the ones who talked me into bottling it. Mm-hmm. Now we got to go see everybody. But I would say, yeah, the restaurant, really, that was really the main thing of the community, the people, you know, children growing up there and coming in and knowing that they could eat healthy. So many kids have health issues now, allergies and things like that, and they always knew they could come there and we would cater to everything that they needed. So that was a different feel, a different kind of love, like what you were talking about, and Miriam. And now when we're on the road, you know, we talk to thousands and thousands of people, and across the board, it's like what Miriam was saying. There's so many people are confused. They're in pain. They're uncomfortable. They're trying to eat a little healthier. They're trying to feel better. And they just need it to be simple. And that's the biggest thing. It has to be easy. We're not going to do it if it's not easy. And so to be able to share it with people and see people's face light up of knowing that we can actually relate to where they're coming from, I think that just talking to so many people and giving them clarity is really a different kind of love, you know.
Well, Christy and Miriam, I want to thank you both so much for taking the time to visit me in the studio today.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate you.
Christy Linebaugh and Miriam Vigoa are the founders of Vigoa Cuisine and Olive Oils. You can find them in the Expo Center at the State Fair through August 12th.
Coming up, a short history of cats. No, not the musical, but the actual creatures themselves. You are listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Progress is not always linear, and that has certainly been the case for house cats. While their popularity has wavered over the centuries, cats have been an integral part of human history for millennia.
Dr. Paul Koudinaris is, among other things, a cat historian. And in honor of International Cat Day today, Koudinaris will be giving a lecture about the history of American cats at Cafe Lulu.
He sat down with me, and he starts by explaining our cultural perceptions of cats.
We think of them only in modern terms, and we tend to overlook how nasty humanity was to them at one point in time. You know, we're all familiar that with ancient Egypt being kind of like the zenith of feline culture, but we kind of overlook the fact that for several centuries during the Middle Ages, they were persecuted and not liked, and they were burned in bonfires, and they were considered the consorts of witches and the embodiment of the devil. You know, so it's like they were domesticated. They were raised to the highest of the highs, and they were plunged down to the lowest of the lows. And then very, very slowly, by the end of the 19th century, they finally built themselves up to be companions again. Because if you went back in time to like 1850, they would have been considered, even though they were living in a city environment, they'd be considered no better than like a weasel or a raccoon. In terms of the domestication, you know, I always say that we make a big mistake when we think we domesticated animals. It's a partnership, and it always is. And anyone who doesn't believe me, go out and get yourself a bobcat and give it a try and see what happens. You know, back in the days, humans thought they were so crafty, and they came up with this thing called agriculture back in the Neolithic. And they didn't have the foresight to realize that this was heaven for rats and mice, because all this excess that could be stored was free food for them, and they had no ability to combat them. And slowly, the one specific type of cat, which was the North African wildcat, slowly those guys started to figure it out, and they look a lot like a modern tabby would. And they kind of came along and said, hey, all those mice we want to kill, they're all right here. This is a, let's hang out on the outskirts, you know. And then over time, you know, humanity was afraid of them at first. They didn't like them. It would be about the same as having bobcats hanging out. And over time, they realized we need these guys. And so, like I say, it was a partnership because they got something from us and we got something from them. And we probably needed them more than they needed us at first. When they would kill all those rats, eventually humanity would go out and leave them scraps of food to be like, hey, guys, don't leave. Don't leave because we know what happens when you leave. And eventually, you know, eventually that magic moment occurred somewhere back in the Middle East where some guy stretches out his hand and some cat puts his head up and that first pet is made. But it's a partnership with them, and it always has been. And a lot of people will tell you it's like it's more than just a partnership. My cat's actually in charge.
It's funny because when you go back to, you know, you talked about the changes in how we view cats. When you go back to specifically the plague,
yeah.
in England, you know, they killed all the dogs, they killed all the cats,
yeah.
And it just caused the plague to, you know, bloom because they were no longer killing these rats.
Well, I have a statistic for you, actually, on that. That is nauseating probably for a lot of people to hear. First of all, controlling rats. And originally in Europe, it was the brown rat, which wasn't as bad as the black rat, but the black rat came back with the Crusaders. Controlling rats, in considering, you know, medieval sanitation and the kind of way they were living, a lot of people were living in like what we would consider like a beaver lodge or something practically, that was heaven for rats. And it was hard enough to control them even with a healthy feline population. But once you start not only decimating them but chasing them away from your habitations, those rats are going to breed and breed and breed. Something like a pair of black rats can within 3 years breed something like a million others. And on the average in the Middle Ages, there were 10 rats per household. So humans were outnumbered by rats in their own household. And like I said, it would have been hard enough to control them even with a healthy feline population. Without that, those people were doomed. And they did get their comeuppance for that war against cats. They got their comeuppance by realizing, like I said, go back to the beginning. We needed them at the start more than they needed us, and it turned out we really did still need them at some point in time.
So when did we, specifically here in America, where for a long time cats were, again, not terribly welcome, when did we go from these are street animals, these are unwanted, to let's bring them in?
America has an interesting relationship with cats. I like to say, and this is why the talk I'm doing in Milwaukee is specifically about the history of American cats, because it's a fascinating topic, because there is no country in the world where the history of the people and the history of the cats is so closely tied, so closely unified. You know, America was founded by these outcasts who came from Europe, but they came on those boats with cats because cats were needed to kill rats and mice on those ships. We don't, you know, we look at the Mayflower and all those ships as bringing human colonists, but we don't realize they brought feline colonists too because it was a one-way trip. So those cats also got off those boats at the same time as those people, and they founded their own feline states of America, you know? And Europe was still persecuting cats, but there was something about American ingenuity that was more about, like, we want to know what value things have, you know, more than really the spiritual detriment of having a cat around, you know. And so America was more interested in trying to find ways to put them to work. You know, there's this old theory in England that Isaac Newton invented the cat door, as if it takes, you know, a genius in astrophysics in order to figure out a cat door. It's not true. You know who invented it? American farmers. Because they didn't really want them as pets yet, but at the same time, they knew these guys can help us. So they made these little doors so the cats could go in and out. Even wild cats could go in and out and kill rats. America was the first country in the world to write cats into its national budget. In the 19th century, the Treasury Department wrote cats into the budget to protect the mail. The first budget involving cats included $1,000 for the U.S. Postal Service, $100 to New York, $10 to Philadelphia, and so on down the line, depending on the size of the post office. And it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but remember, these cats were supposed to be feeding themselves. But if the cats would kill all those mice, they'd be like, yeah, we want to feed these guys. These are government employees. The United States Army, people don't know this, we think of, you know, war dogs, right? The United States Army had hired cats long before they had hired dogs. The United States Army had hired cats in the 19th century, again, to protect the commissaries. And every commissary had cats. We did not have a dog service in the United States Army until World War I. So, the United States embraced cats more than any other country. But they're not really pets. Like I say, they're more like service animals. It's something that comes in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Interestingly, again, the parallel between American people and American cats, it was in the West where the cats made their name. It wasn't back in the East, because we expect, you know, American culture to flow east to west. A lot of cats had wound up going out west, and people don't realize that a lot of cowboys had cats too, and some of them would even ride with them on their saddle, you know, because they wanted to protect their rations from field mice when they would stay somewhere for the night, because, you know, this guy's going out for 3 months at a time. He can't afford to lose his rations, so he might bring a cat along with him. And think for a second about, you know, some cowboy, lonesome guy on the trail, all he's got is this cat. You know he's going to become friends with that damn animal because they're good animals and they're nice animals. And so they started becoming accepted more in the West, and then that filters back to the East. And once it starts filtering back to the East, it gets picked up by the avant-garde, you know, the independent thinkers, guys like Mark Twain. He was one of the first great Americans to love cats. The writers all started loving cats. In a way, it was a way to kind of like flaunt social mores and take the anti-pet. Going to take the cat instead of a dog, but they'd also found something in them, the Americans. It was the Americans who realized, I think for the first time, something the ancients realized, that a cat is an enigma. And in being an enigma, it can be a muse. And so it was the American literati and all the artists, and these articles would come out in the newspaper that said, you know, it's like, hey, if you want to be a writer, get yourself a cat. And so it was around that time, it was around the late 19th, early 20th centuries, they really start being accepted in American culture. It starts with the aesthetes. It starts with the writers and the painters, and you know how that goes. You know, it's like they're the bearers of culture. So once they start doing it, everybody else starts crashing the party.
So I know that you're researching a book, really, mm-hmm. about cats. What are some of the more interesting cats that you've come across as you've been doing the research, specific cats?
Yeah, there's some great ones. America, as I said, really has a great history in cats. In the 1890s, there was a cat in Chicago by the name of Toots Willard. And Toots Willard was the temperance cat. Toots Willard was the cat who saved America from public drunkenness. And Toots Willard was owned by a woman who was very big in the temperance movement. And she used to bring this cat around to temperance meetings. And Toots Willard was this enormous cat, like 30 pounds. So it was kind of like... It just worked because of its freak appeal. Like, they'd sell pictures of Toots Willard. It was kind of like nowadays if they sent, like, a 60-pound raccoon to a grammar school to tell kids to stay off of opioids or something. It was just like it had this weird freak appeal. So Toots Willard was this really big deal. And he raised thousands and thousands of dollars for the temperance movement in America. He was, like, the public face of the temperance movement. Our first celebrity cat... was, you know, we think now, oh, well, it's the day of the cats because of the internet, you know. We don't realize how big some of these animals were and how famous they were in their day, because we remember human history and we don't tell it from, you know, the animal's perspective. There was a cat by the name of Kiddo, who was an airship cat, who was super famous because the first dirigible aircraft to ever try to cross the Atlantic crashed. For all the humans, there was humiliation, but it wasn't the cat's fault. So kind of like to put a spin on it, they're like, hey, aviating cat, and everybody went for it. And this cat went on a national tour in 1911. This cat, Kiddo, was making $2,000 a week. In 1911, when money meant something, that's a big deal cat. $2,000 a week in 1911. So we've had our share of really fascinating cats that people have forgotten. Another of America's first famous cats was the Brooklyn Borough Cat, a cat by the name of Jerry Fox, who was famous because he wore spectacles. When his eyes started to go bad, they had fit him with a tiny little pair of glasses and somehow gave him an eye test. So we've had this wonderful history of these very colorful animals. You know, there's something much more to a cat than sitting on a couch if you'll let it be something more.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing so much about cat history, so much that I didn't know. And thanks for joining us here in Milwaukee.
Thank you so much.
Paul Kudinaris is a cat historian who's in Milwaukee for a talk on the history of American cats. Proceeds will go to benefit the Wisconsin Humane Society. And for more information, you can go to WUWM.com.
Coming up next, Radio Chipstone talks about some of the ways in which information technology and museums could learn from one another. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Before the break, we heard about the work of the Wisconsin Designer Crafts Council. The century-old organization, which was founded in Milwaukee, works to promote fine craft throughout the state. One of their signature events is the yearly Morning Glory Fine Crafts Fair, which takes place on the Marcus Center grounds this weekend. The fair features juried work from artists around the world.
One of those artists showing her work this year is metalsmith Sarah Mann. Mann grew up in Milwaukee before moving away for school and other work, but she's been back in the area for a while now, and she works out of her studio in the basement of her Whitefish Bay home. That's where I met her recently to find out more about her and her work.
I studied metalsmithing when I was in college in St. Louis at Washington University under a phenomenal artist, Heikki Seppä, and that's really where my love of metalsmithing came from. I love the permanence of working in metal. I worked in a lot of different other medium, and metalsmithing really took my heart. And then I moved to New Orleans and started working for a metalsmith there. And on the side, I was doing my own metalsmithing and realized that I was devoting so much time to his work and I could do my own work instead. And so I took a leap of faith and started my own business.
But you're from here, right? Did you start doing art here in Milwaukee?
Actually, I did. I started before I went to Washington University, when I was in high school, I was taking metalsmithing classes at UWM in the evening, just for fun. And those were casting classes. And those were just for fun, and it didn't occur to me that I could make a career out of it until I went to school and then pursued it after that in my own business.
When you look at a piece of metal that has not yet become something, where do you start? Are you thinking of something ahead of time, or do you let the metal tell you what it needs to be?
I've worked in other metals, but I work pretty much for my own work in silver. And that's what appeals to me most. It's what I've always been drawn to. I think I like the color of it. I like how the metal itself is workable, the strength of it, the way that it bends and melts. So I love silver out of all the metals that I've worked with most. And so I think of what I do for each. I tend to work in series of work. Like I put out two or three series of work a year that includes necklaces and bracelets and rings and earrings, of course. And with each series, I'm responding to something that piqued my interest, either aesthetically, a shape, or some sort of kinetic element, or a challenge that I'm working through. So yeah, those are generally the things that I'm responding to with each series.
So it's not the metal itself so much that's dictating to you what it needs to be. It's something else that you then work with the metal to explore.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do you always work in jewelry, or do you also do sculpture and things that are not wearable?
Pretty much only jewelry. And I design my own pieces and make them. But I also do custom work for people who want specific things. They have to be within my vocabulary and style. But yeah, so that's how I work.
Like what? What would you consider something? If I were to come to you and say, I'd like something, what kinds of things would you be comfortable doing?
Well, I don't typically work in stones, although I do some pieces for myself every once in a while. But sometimes folks will come to me and they'll want a stone set, or they have a particular design idea in mind, like they want a necklace, but they're not sure how to execute it. And they usually know me and my work, so they're comfortable with my design style and having it in that style. And so I'll just hear what they want to have done and draw up some sketches, and we'll work together in getting it executed.
Well, that takes me right into executing from concept to actual piece holding in your hand or wearing it or whatever it is. Do you start with sketches?
Typically, yes. It's always helpful to see it on paper before working in metal because you don't really want to waste the metal. You don't want to practice so much on the metal. Although I have a pretty good sense of how the metal is going to respond and what it's going to look like, that oftentimes I do dive in right onto the metal, but I like to draw it out because it's amazing what's revealed in the drawing that you're not necessarily thinking about. And as it comes to life on the paper, then you can do some problem solving and see what needs to be adjusted and tweaked. And then the same thing happens once you bring it from paper drawing into the metal. Things always change and evolve, so it's fun to see how things take shape over the course of a thought coming to life in a piece of jewelry.
Has there ever been a piece that you drew out on paper and thought, oh, this is going to be fantastic, and then when you tried to make it in metal said, I can't do this, for whatever reason? You didn't think through a certain part of the process or something?
Definitely, yes. That happens, and sometimes I get the sense when I'm drawing it out or when I'm testing it out, I just get this gut feeling that this isn't where I want to be heading. And sure enough, it doesn't turn into anything that I'm really pleased about, but that's sort of like the happy accident phenomenon. Even if that piece isn't something that I'm interested in, it usually leads to another train of thought that will turn into a piece of jewelry that I like. So it's important to follow all of those little roads to see where they might lead.
Even if it's quote-unquote a mistake, it's a good mistake.
You got it. And sometimes those mistakes I just keep around, and I'll revisit them and see if I can adjust them and turn them into something else or use a part of it. So nothing is ultimately a mistake. It always sort of turns into something that I might use or at least trigger some train of thought that will turn into something that I really like.
So how long have you been doing this as a profession?
Oh, over 25 years.
Okay, so that's a long time. In that 25 years, how do you feel your design aesthetic has changed?
Some things haven't changed at all. Like, they're very recognizable as things that I would make. My style in some ways has remained pretty similar, but other things have made big leaps. Like, I used to work big, chunky, maybe that's a 1980s thing, that it was, the jewelry was much bigger and chunkier and kind of heavier. And now my work is a little bit more organic and light. So I think that's been a trend in my jewelry. Interestingly, it's coincided with my eyesight kind of fading and my needing sharper glasses as I'm working smaller. So
it's funny how that works. It's like, oh my goodness. Yeah, you'd think you'd almost go to the opposite, to the bigger.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think also the way that my jewelry has trended aesthetically really reflects what I like. I mean, all the jewelry that I make over the years has always been something that I've wanted to wear myself before presenting it to the public. So I guess I'm sort of interested in jewelry that's smaller, maybe a little bit more delicate, lighter, easier to wear, less sculptural in some ways.
The thing I love about jewelry, well, yes, I love to wear it, but thinking of it on a slightly higher level, the thing I love about it is it is adornment. It is art that we wear, that we present to the world. And, you know, a lot of times on this show, I've had discussions with particularly fine craftspeople, fine artisans, about that line between craft and art. And I don't think it really exists. I think that's kind of a made-up thing that you have as much skill and as much artistic vision as a jeweler as you do as a painter. It's just a different medium. Do you find that people think of you, or have you ever had to push back at that idea that's like, no, I really am an artist, even though I work with something that you ultimately are going to wear as opposed to hang on your wall?
No, that's never been an issue. At least I haven't experienced it as not being recognized as an artist. There's an advantage of being a jeweler that the pieces are worn, so they might be a little bit more accessible to the general public, and people tend to gravitate towards jewelry when I'm doing shows, because it's an easy gift to give also. So not only are people purchasing for themselves, but they're purchasing for loved ones. But I've never had a problem with being recognized as an artist, and maybe that's has something to do with my style of work. It doesn't look very commercial. It's very sort of artistic looking.
It has a point of view, which I think is really important. And, you know, we're sitting here at your table looking at some examples of your work. And the two things that have jumped out at me is that ring over there. I'll have you describe all of this. And then these earrings right here. And to me, they have a very specific style and point of view, like any art.
Right. And both of them are very sort of technique driven. I learned different techniques right before I made the series that both of those pieces that you're pointing out were designed and made. There's something else that I like to incorporate in all of my work, and that's a surface treatment. So the style of jewelry is described as pretty modern and clean designs, simple in a certain way, but highly stylized also. And even in their simplicity, there's little details about the work that if you look closely, you'll notice the different surface treatments. And for example, on the ring that you're pointing out, it has what's called a Mizzi wheel texture, which is a stone, a rotating stone that I draw across the surface. So it really brings the piece to life in a certain way. And same thing with the earrings that you're pointing out. This has a different sort of texture on it. So even in the simplicity of the design, it adds a little depth to the piece.
Give me an idea of how long it takes you from start to finish. And I realize that would change depending on how complicated the piece is. But let's say this ring that I'm drawn to, how long approximately did that take you to make?
Well, not taking into consideration the design time, if I'm just talking about the construction, I'd say a couple of hours. There's different parts of the process of making the piece, and then you have to let it sit in what's called a pickle, and then I put a patina on it, and then that tumbles in order to remove some of the patina and just leave the highlights shining. And so it's not a couple of hours straight through. It takes several hours with breaks in between where I'm putting my focus and attention on other pieces.
So how many are you working on at any given time?
Well, I like to think of it, of my jewelry as not one-of-a-kind pieces, but a limited edition where I make several pieces. So if I'm getting ready for a show like the Morning Glory Fine Craft Fair that's coming up, I'll make a few, particularly in the ring department, so that I can have several ring sizes for people to try on. And then I just keep the piece alive as long as I'm interested in making it and as long as people are interested in buying it. But as soon as I'm done, I'm done. And every once in a while, I'll revive a piece from the past or I'll alter it from its original design to bring it into something a little bit more current or something that I'm a little bit more interested in making, or I'll solve a problem on it that I want to work on. So I make a piece, several pieces, and then I'll either retire it or keep it going. Like, there's a pair of earrings that I have that one of my first pair of earrings, and I'm still making it 25 years later. I just love them. They really are like little sculptures for your ears. And then there's other pieces that I've retired after a year because they're really challenging to make, or they're just not getting enough reception, or whatever the case may be, I retire a piece too.
How important is a fair like Morning Glory to someone like yourself who is making a living doing this? Is this kind of thing really important?
Well, there's lots of different avenues for jewelers and artists in general to be selling their work on the internet, in galleries, on their own website, doing shows like this. That's just some of the main ones. So depending on the artist, they may sell their work or have more success in different venues than others. I happen to really love doing shows because it's not often that I get to interface with the public working in my studio like I do. And so it's fun for me to sell on the internet and in galleries, but doing the shows is just a fabulous way to get to know the folks that are buying my work and for them to be able to meet the artist. Particularly at a show like the Morning Glory Fine Craft Fair that is run by professional artists for the most part, who really understand what it takes to put on a show and what it means for an artist to be in a show and have them interacting with the public. And I've been doing the Morning Glory Fine Craft Fair since I was living in New York. So I used to come home in the summer to do the show. And now that I'm living in Milwaukee, it's a lot easier for me to do, obviously. But it's great. It's one of the linchpins of my summer show season.
If someone, a young person, came to you and said, I want to be a jeweler, what's the most important thing you can pass on to them that you've learned over 25 years of doing this?
Follow your own design style. Do not try to figure out what people want and make what they want. Figure out what you like. Make what you like, and if you're really passionate about your work, there's someone out there who's going to be equally passionate about purchasing it. I guarantee it.
Well, Sarah Mann, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Metalsmith Sarah Mann spoke to us at her Whitefish Bay studio. She is one of the artists showing her work at this weekend's Morning Glory Fine Crafts Fair. You can see some pictures of Mann at work as well as some photos of her finished pieces at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Tomorrow we'll have the final two Democratic gubernatorial candidate profiles here on Lake Effect. Plus, we'll have an analysis of the Milwaukee County Sheriff's race on our weekend show.
We'd like to thank you so much for tuning in today. Lake Effect comes your way weekdays at 10 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.